This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Florence, Alabama. Come along and join me for a conversation with Natalie Channon. What a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, thank you for coming, making the trip down here.
Renowned fashion designer in Florence, Alabama. You think of Manhattan, you know, or Paris, Rome, and here you are happy as a clam. This is really a fascinating journey. Go back in time. How did it first start?
Well, I've always had a great love of textiles. Both of my grandmothers were very avid sewers and made all the clothes for their family. And so I grew up around a lot of makers, you know, people who made everything from, you know, bread to, as I mentioned, you know, prom dresses to everyday clothes. And so that really was where the journey, I would say, my journey as a designer began.
Junior high and high school, did you make some of your own dresses?
You know, I was always more of a crafter. Like, I really enjoyed embroidery and crochet and doing some things like that. You know, I was not a very good machine sewer at the time. In fact, when I was in the ninth grade, I took home economics class, and I believe the home economics teacher said to me, "You will never learn how to sew."
Oh, wow. But, encouraging words.
But I did, finally, you know. But I really connected with sewing by hand more than sewing by machines.
So. Interesting.
Even though today we do have a machine manufacturing division, but the joke that the machines go haywire when I walk by, so...
happens to a daughter when she goes by a computer. Literally.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Here you are, high school graduate, Florence.
I spent part of my high school years in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and then I wound up graduating from the high school here.
So then what was your dream? What did you think you were going to go off and do?
Well, you know, I was one of those kids that was a little bit lost after high school. And, you know, I did love making and I wanted to travel. And so I did a little bit of that and wound up in North Carolina and eventually was able to study design at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. They have a beautiful design school there as well as a textile school. So I
In the design, it was more than on fabric. It would have been paper or
everything, really. Mm-hmm. I was really lucky. I wound up at the College of Design at a time when they were thinking about like Bauhaus kind of studies. So there was Black Mountain College was in Black Mountain, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Was a place where a lot of people from the Bauhaus landed after they left Europe. And
so in intuiting simplistic reductionist?
Yeah, it really is more about the whole environment.
Okay.
So, and they had a very specific educational program where it started very broad and had a lot to do with materials and then increasingly got more and more specific. So actually my education, I wound up with a degree in environmental design, which sounds like environmentalism. Really, the Bauhaus, the concept behind it was that everything in your environment matters. So everything from the furniture to the building, the landscape, the textiles, everything about it.
So shades of arts and crafts, right?
Yeah. Well, it was. It followed on the heels of the arts and crafts movement, and it was very hands-on. So, you know, my first year in design school, you had to learn to do woodworking and metalworking and really learn everything that you could all about materials.
Wow.
So hence that idea that everything in the environment matters. My focus was on textiles, and I wound up doing a double major in textiles and design, which today is called the Annie Albers program. So Annie Albers was involved in the Bauhaus movement as well. She was a brilliant weaver and the wife of Joseph Albers, a famous Bauhaus teacher and artist in his own right. Yeah, so I got this kind of very unique education between industrial textiles and design theory.
This is maybe a little too abstract, but just intuiting into you. Did you find you're working in a different material? You're working with metals, say. Did you later extrapolate it and applied something you learned in an alternative material to fabric?
I would say absolutely yes, in so many ways. So my dad was a builder. He was a commercial contractor. And so I grew up on construction sites. And, you know, I always used to joke with my dad that, you know, I'm a contractor too. I'm just not building with concrete. I'm using threads and fabrics. Mm-hmm. And so I think the answer to that is would have to be yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and your dad starts with the foundation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is where you start in a whole nother material.
Yeah. You know, we have two arms of our collection. One is completely sewn by hand, and we work with artisans in this region who work as independent contractors. So my dad, obviously, in his business, had worked with independent contractors for many, many years. And so he was a great wealth of knowledge just about bidding systems and structures and how to put things like that together. So he was very instrumental in helping me figure out how to run that artisan program.
Looking in from the outside, so here you go, you reach out to independent creatives, right?
Right.
And they have their own vision, their own image, but under the label of Natalie's ultimate projection out to the world, how do you create that overarching cohesiveness and unity while still having that individualism?
That's a really great question because, you know, we definitely had to come up with some structures because, you know, at the largest, we were working with about 120 women that were all sewing from a different location. And so it was really critical that we have some structures in place where, you know, if a store ordered a particular shirt, they all had to sort of look the same coming back to them. I mean, we've always been celebrated for things that are, you know, they're almost alike, but everyone is unique. And so we just came up with some systems for handling materials, and we use the same system today. We cut kits, so part of the work is done by our team here in the studio, and then those kits are passed to these artisans who are, you know, just highly talented and highly skilled, and then they transform those materials into these finished garments and then sell them back to us.
Very fascinating. And it's almost like you're holding your breath in the meantime, right? Wondering.
Yeah. Well, we've been doing it a long time. Some of our very first sewists are still sewing with us, so, you know, over time you learn one another's languages, and so it's been a great journey with all of these talented women.
So fascinating, because by default they have to have their own signature within there, but yet the overarching is the Natalie signature.
Yeah, it's interesting because every person has, you know, a stitch is a bit like handwriting. It depends on your hand creates that, and so no two pieces are really ever alike because, you know, their stencil are painted by hand, they're cut by hand, they're sewn by hand, and so everyone has its own unique character.
And I understand reading a little bit about you that organic and authentic materials is essential and center to you, right?
Yeah, we have a commitment to, you know, the highest possible quality and organics. And so, you know, we've been working with the Texas Organic Cotton Growers Association now almost two decades. So it's kind of unusual in the U.S. even today to have this unbroken supply chain. You know, our fiber is grown in Texas. It's ginned there and then processed in North Carolina, which means it turned into yarn, knit, dyed, and then it comes back to us here in Alabama for cutting, stenciling, painting, sewing, and then out into the world for its next life.
In pretty much primarily cotton.
We are working exclusively with cotton currently.
Have thought of bamboo?
We have. We've tried all kinds of different materials. So we did some explorations with bamboo, you know, off and on over the years. But our machines and our structure is more or less is set up for cotton. And so that is best for us. We've even tried like high-tech fabrics that are, you know, made from man-made, environmentally friendly fibers. We've tried really everything, but it seems like we always wind up going back to our cotton
roots.
Isn't
that interesting?
Yeah.
Literal roots in materials, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, this is cotton country, obviously, for all of its, you know, ugly history and you know, beauty and all the things. But and this was once known as the t-shirt capital of the world, and this building that we're in was kind of the centralized hub of that manufacturing process. So one of the reasons that this happened, of course, was that this was a vertical community, that it was grown here, gin here, spun, knit, dyed, cut, embroidered, sewn, like the whole way through. And so it is really interesting that, you know, I came back to my hometown after, more or less after most of the industry had collapsed after NAFTA, and really went back to the roots of the textile industry that had thrived here before. So,
do you ever dive back into regional history? You know, here you are, where you had sharecroppers, Great Depression, mothers having to take flour sacks to make dresses and whatnot for the kids. Do you ever look back in time to get ideas from that basis for today?
Yes, and I have a two-pronged answer to that. So absolutely, yes, especially when I first came home to do this work. I did a documentary film about old-time quilting circles, and so we did really a deep dive into what was happening here in the era of my childhood. But, you know, when I first returned home, it was the year 2000, and, you know, NAFTA had not fully shut down the industry here, but much of the industry had already begun to close, and many of the people that were working with us at that time had worked in or around textiles. And so, inspired by the Southern Foodways Alliance and the Center for the Study of Southern Culture, we started collecting oral histories of these textile workers, because it occurred to me, even at that time, some of the people we were working with who were sewing for us were already older, and so the stories of the factories were beginning to pass away. And so, you know, we really spent a lot of time delving into that history. I mean, also, you can't really work in cotton in this region and not look back and see the ugliness of that and the brutality of what that industry was, because it was indeed an industry. And so to do this, we founded a not-for-profit organization called Project Threadways that is now working in partnership with the Muscle Shoals National Heritage Area and the National Park Service to really collect stories, to collect these histories, to try to document them, to try to save some of the data around, you know, everything from factory workers all the way back to plantations. And so we're really proud of that work, and it's been very inspiring for the company to be a part of this.
That's really cool. Is there a go-to website?
Yes, it's projectthreadways.org.
Okay, back to Natalie's life journey. It's somehow, some point, you wound up in Austria.
I did.
What brought you there?
Well, actually, it had to do with when I was in university. The university had an exchange program with a university there, and so I came to know some of the people who had gone back and forth, and then I wound up working as a stylist for many, many years there. It was really wonderful.
Stylist, more in design, conceptual?
Yes. So when I left college, the College of Design, I worked in what's called the junior sportswear industry. So it's, you know, in New York and much more like mainstream fashion. And after that, I kind of switched to the other side. So I was working on television commercials and music videos and print ads. Things
as a
like
stylist.
That. As a stylist, yes.
Yeah, so. I have a friend in Nashville that wants to meet you. She's a stylist.
Oh,
she's really cool.
Yeah. Awesome. I'll look forward to that.
Okay. So somehow you get from Austria, you wind up in Manhattan, and you're invited to a party, and you have nothing, the legend, nothing
yeah,
to wear.
Yeah, this is the urban legend
yeah.
of my work. But it is true. I had gone on a sabbatical from my life as a stylist and really had been living out of a backpack. And so I had been wearing t-shirts, and I cut these t-shirts up and sewed them back together again by hand. And
just for fun?
Well, I was looking for something to wear.
Uh-huh.
And also inspired by this, I had spent a lot of time at the 26th Street Flea Market in Manhattan, and inspired by this corset that I found, I began cutting up these t-shirts, and so I didn't have a sewing machine, so I was using hand sewing, and there was a hardware store just down the street from where I was living, and, you know, I bought some thread, and I bought some needles, and you know, the whole thing started because I had been working on a self-portrait project, so I'd been taking my photograph every day, and so I started making a t-shirt every day after that very first t-shirt, and I just couldn't stop, and people would approach me on the street and say, you know, where did you get that? What is it? Can you make one for me? And so it eventually wound up that I was just sewing for myself and for other people all the time, and began to look for manufacturers in New York.
But there was that legend that you're at a cocktail party.
It was a friend of mine who I just recently spoke with. It was his birthday, and I wore this t-shirt to the party. And
because you had nothing.
I didn't really have anything fancy to wear, and it seemed to me like it was going to be a very, you know, fashion fabulous party. And so I wanted to have an outfit that was appropriate for the evening, and so I wore this t-shirt there. And you know, I always make the joke that people in New York don't really approach you and touch you or anything, so people would come across and kind of touch it and ask me what this was. And you know, I always say that, you know, of course I really loved that my design, you know, resonated with these friends, but what really resonated with me was this act of making. So I had, you know, I was a trained designer, and I had worked as a stylist, I'd worked as a fashion designer, but it had been a really long time since I had made something with my hands. And so I got up the next day, and I felt very inspired to make another one, and another one, and another one. And so hence, you know, I started making these shirts for the self-portraits. Yeah, it just evolved from there. So,
did you have people ask to carry your work in their shops?
Well, that was another... I did have someone, you know, approach me about making t-shirts for a website, which was 2000, so it was very early in that genre. And so I think we had to make like 60 shirts, something like that. And so I, you know, it was very difficult, like, to produce all 60 of them. And so I started looking for manufacturers, and that was, you know, around that time I had this vision of making these 200 one-of-a-kind shirts, and started approaching embroidery shops in New York City to see if I could find some embroiderers there to help me do the work. And that's when, you know, I always make the joke that I think they thought I was a bag lady, because they would, you know, I was coming in with these cut-up t-shirts from the Goodwill, and in a, you know, in the, that iconic, you know, I Heart New York bag. And so I was just, you know, every place I went, they were like, no, we can't do that. And, you know, it was in that moment one day, I mean, I remember it very specifically. I was standing on 38th and 8th Avenue, and I couldn't really figure out why I couldn't find someone to do it. And then it occurred to me that it really was just a quilting stitch, and that if I wanted to find quilters, I just needed to come home. And
so that's what brought you back.
That's what brought me back.
Wow.
So, to quilting. Find these quilters.
I love it.
Yeah, my grandmother was still alive at the time, and I remembered that some of the ladies that she had quilted with in her younger days were still quilting at this little community center out near where I was born. And I indeed went there, and then I got to interview them and make a film with them, and little short documentary film. And I wound up moving back to this community of my early childhood. And
here's a quilting aside. I was around Sevierville, and there was this outdoor conference, and one of the courses you could take was quilting.
Yeah.
And so I signed up for it.
Oh, good for
and
you.
I walk in, and these 16 women look up from their sewing machines like, this guy's got the wrong room. I go, no, I wanted to be here.
Did you make a quilt?
Well, they taught, you know, basic pattern, but that's what I wanted to learn. How do they work? How do they make scraps into magic?
I love that.
Yeah,
that's
so
wonderful.
It's okay. So here you are. You've come back, and you've found people to bring your visions home physically. How do you then share it with the world? you know, what happened from there to make it a viable mm-hmm. business?
So I had some friends and partners by that point, and we made a little catalog and sent it around. Another friend gave us a mailing list to, like, who she thought the top 200 most important people to see the catalog would be. And so we sent the catalog out, and I was living at the Hotel Chelsea at the time on 23rd Street, and so we invited guests to come and view the collection and a little trailer for the documentary film in the Hotel Chelsea. And my friend showed that first collection, and while I cut the documentary film trailer. And then there's a really great story about Julie Gilhart from Barney's New York. She was the fashion director at the time, about coming back to her desk after she had been on vacation and pulling one catalog out of a stack of invitations, and it was my catalog. Wow. And so she called the Chelsea and made an appointment, and the rest, yeah.
That's
I'm
so
still
cool.
here. I thought I was coming here for like 2 months to do this one project,
right.
and then we would sell those shirts, and then I would be going back to making films and doing that kind of thing. So.
How funny. Accidental.
Accidental. Yeah. 20 years later, here, yeah. here I am.
It's so weird how life works. You know, if you turn left at the intersection, your life has changed forever rather than right.
Yeah, I would never have imagined that I would still be here today, but... Mm-hmm. One of our sewers stopped me in the parking lot here last week, and she said, I told you 20 years later we'd be doing this and that you would retire from this. And I just laughed and said, you're right. You were right. I never would have in a million years believed it. But
are your products available retail in New York City, Manhattan?
No, we currently sell primarily direct to customers. So
online.
We sell online, and then we do trunk shows and things like that. But
and where do you do those? Anywhere?
Well, recently, nowhere.
Yeah, really. Next year.
Next year. Yes, we've done them all over the country. You know, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Texas. So
it's a pretty smart model dealing direct, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we opened our first online store in 2006. It was just a tiny little site that mm-hmm. I actually built myself. And, you know, it was very, I didn't think about it at the time, about it being very, very early in that journey. But, so we've been selling direct to we've been selling online. Mm-hmm. 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a long time.
You have to be late to realize you were early.
Yeah.
Because it's only looking back, you know, that at the moment, at the time, you don't even know where the project is going.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seemed like, we were, you know, I was just lucky to come home right as all of this was beginning to crack open. You mm-hmm. know, infrastructures in terms of shipping and all of those things changed radically in the early 2000s. And so I was living in a rural community, but able to work in a global community. And, you know, the infrastructure, the internet, all of these things made that possible.
So you're here totally by choice.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have a good friend who is a lawyer, and he said to me, you know, people never understand that I don't have to live here. I choose to live here.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, and you probably, to a degree, pay some sort of price for that, but it's not in the spiritual realm, so it doesn't matter.
Well, I think, you know, you're right. You have... There are advantages and disadvantages to every place.
Yeah.
And you just have to look for the good. And
Well, I think it's, too, you seem real comfortable with your world. There isn't that conqueror to build the empire syndrome, right?
No.
Yeah. So
I don't need to own the world.
Yeah. So you'd have to be in Manhattan if you wanted to keep that ball going.
Yeah. My same friend who said he chose to live here... you know, just gave me such great advice. He asked me at a very particular point in my life where a lot of changes were happening. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, what do you want your life to look like? And he, you know, queried me to write down what my life would look like. Mm-hmm. And He said, you know, you can have that like this. And so I've never forgotten that. You know, what do I want my life to look like right now?
Yeah.
And what do I need for that to happen? And, you know, it's funny. At that time, I thought I needed so much more. But he said, you know, you really don't need that much to make your life. If these are the things that are important to you, then you don't need very much to make this choice. And so
he was like a spirit guide friend.
Huh? He was.
Yeah.
And so I've never forgotten that, you know. I had a small child at that time, and I wanted her to be raised close to family. And, you know, I have a grown son who was living here at the same time, too. And so, you know, to have him close by, and it just seemed like such a natural decision. I also wasn't 20.
Right.
You know?
But sometimes people don't have that option. You know, the stories are legion about people leaving the small town out of necessity.
Right.
To go to the big city.
Well, I definitely felt that way when I was younger. You know, I remember traveling and thinking, oh, the first thing I wanted to do was go to a bookstore, you know, and like the Strand in New York City. And, you know, all of those things weren't available in a smaller community at that time. And so there was a time when you did have to leave. You know, that has changed tremendously now. We live in a different era, but I remember that time where what we do here now would not have been possible.
Yeah. Okay, let's shift back to Natalie's brain and into creativity and your vision, your dreams of manifesting things that you think about.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still happening and ongoing in a fabric sense and an application?
Yes. So I actually have been working really hard to work less in the business so that I can get back to more design and writing, which is my favorite part of what I do. And so, yeah, you know, there's a lot of really great things happening right now. You know, we're collections that we're working on. I'm working on a book currently and kind of about the company. You know, we're working potentially on a new store in the downtown area. So there's a lot of great irons in the fire right now.
Okay, right now, talk a little bit, if you can, translate into simplistic pattern and motifs. What are you trying to say visually?
Mm-hmm. So the current collection that we're working on right now, so the company is 21 years old this year, and we had intended to celebrate 20 years, and
go for 21.
Everything kind of went sideways in 2020. So we're working on our 21-year celebration now, which even 21 has always been my favorite number. So I think it worked out the way it was supposed to be. So the collections currently, we're going all the way back to the beginning of the company and telling this 20-year story. And so a lot of it is inspired by some of the milestones of what has happened over the years. So using ourselves as inspiration for ourselves. That has been really fun. We're organizing, have a pretty robust archive, and we're organizing the archive and hopefully passing some of this off to the Alabama archives down in Montgomery. And we've been connecting with friends across the globe and telling stories and taking pictures of old pieces and beloved pieces and things like that.
Are you doing some retro stuff back at the beginning?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So we've been looking back at old patterns and things like that, and that's been very exciting to.
And what's the breadth of your product line that you do now? You started out t-shirts, right?
Yes, so we started out only doing t-shirts, and now we have a full collection. We have everything from so there's, I mentioned before, I think there's two parts of the collection. We still have the completely handmade, which would be considered the couture part of our organization, and then we have a machine made line that uses organic cotton for basics, so to mix in with the and some pieces not so basic to mix in with our hand-sewn collection. And so, you know, on view here in the store, you can see all of that, everything from like a beautifully hand-embroidered long skirt that could be worn on the red carpet or for a, you know, a special event to like a really simple, very beautiful slip dress that you can wear, you know, to bed, around the house, or out to dinner. Mm-hmm. So it kind of encompasses everything from coats to skirts and tops and wraps and aprons. And we have collaborations with dishes with Heath Ceramics in California. We also here in 2010, we began a new part of the business called the School of Making, which...
We're in the school right now,
yeah,
right?
It's the educational arm of our organization. So we open sourced some of the methods that we're using, and we teach those methods to anyone who would like to learn them. And so you can come here and...
Practical examples of some of the things that I would learn here.
Okay, so we have embroidery workshops just to learn, like, embroidery stitches. We have what we call a three-day workshop, which really teaches someone how to make one of our garments from beginning to end. We have pattern-making workshops that last 5 days.
And people come from all over?
All over the world.
Yeah.
We throw parties and have dinners and write books and, yeah.
That's cool. So do you help them with places to stay? And,
yes. Yeah. So we have some really great hotels and restaurants and great things to see. We organize tours of the region, and we have a beautiful Frank Lloyd Wright house here, and just all kinds of adventures. So.
I was blown away when I first stayed at the Marriott. I mean, what an amazing, incredible place.
It is. It's really beautiful because it's right on Wilson Dam. So from your room, you can see the dam and the barges going through. And, you know, that dam was built during the TVA era. So it's part of the WPA works there. You have the dam. And there's just so many interesting, you know, that we were settled by Native American Indians long before the white man was here. There's quite a lot of Indian history in our region. And
back to here, in normal times, is this open to the public? Can they come in? And
yes. So we are sitting in what used to be the cafe. So we had a cafe here, so you could come and have lunch. We give a tour every day at 3:30 in the afternoon. And so, you know, pre-pandemic, we were open for lunch every day, and it would be packed, and we would have tours in the afternoon and that sort of thing. So
okay, regretfully, not because I want to, but we're going to have to wrap because we have people here.
Yeah.
Before we go, I don't know if they told you, but I'm travel editor of Civilian in New York City.
Yes.
So what we decided, we were going to combine you and Billy and also make it Destination Florence.
Oh, awesome.
Okay.
So
question for you. If you were to talk to somebody from New York, Manhattan, whatever, we're talking about, you guys got to come down to Florence. Mm-hmm. What and where are you going to tell them to do? 1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, I definitely would send them out to see the wall, so Tom's Wall, which I'm sure you'll talk about during your show.
Yeah.
And so that's number one on the list because it's really something you can't see anywhere else in the world.
No.
It's an amazing thing that we have here. I do think the Frank Lloyd Wright House is really interesting because it has all of the original furniture in it, mm-hmm. and beautiful decor from the Rosenbaum family is still there, and so it feels like a house that's lived in. It's a very, very beautiful thing to do. And then, you know, we have some things that you won't see anywhere. The Coondog Cemetery is a short drive away from here. The other thing, we have Single Lock Records here, which is a great record producer in the area. Oh, I mean, how can you know what I'm going to say? Number three, maybe number one. I don't know.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You have to go see the Muscle Shoals Studio.
I had no clue.
Amazing.
No clue.
Yeah, amazing.
Nashville and Memphis suck all the air. You know. Yeah.
No, it's been restored, and you know, they do a great job with it. There's Fame Recording Studio as well.
Yeah. Okay. Place to eat.
In downtown Florence, there's Odette, which I absolutely love. I love to have a glass of wine at the Carriage. And then there's a fantastic lunch and early dinner at Rivertown Cafe. Really super delicious. also Esther's is in East Florence now, and they have a beautiful, healthy menu that I eat very, very often. So
it's a foodie's destination?
It is. Yeah. It is. It is.
And then your favorite place to stay?
My favorite place to stay. Well, I love some of the Airbnbs. There's some beautiful historic homes that are now Airbnbs. The Strickland downtown, and then I do love the Marriott. My daughter and I, it has a great pool, and we, it's almost, you know, you can have a staycation there.
Exactly.
And so we'll, ever since my daughter was small, every summer we'll check in there at least for a few days just to have a little R&R on the river.
More regretfully, have to say goodbye. But it's been an absolute delight.
The pleasure's been mine.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And I thank you. I was hoping and praying we'd be able to meet and you wouldn't be off in Milan somewhere.
Yeah. Well, despite flat tires and rain, we made it.
Yeah. Natalie, so. Janet, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Florence, Alabama. We'll see you here.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust preservation initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
Well, I'll be turning 33 next Friday morning. Friday morning 15 years ago, my grandfather called me to his bedside, and he told me there was something I should know. He said, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there are crying, land will save you, wait and see. So I loaded up my car and moved to Denver to work a job and chase big city dreams. But I never found the life I really wanted till I came back home to Leapers Fork, Tennessee. He said, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there crying, land will save you, wait and see. It didn't hit me quite as hard then as those words come through today. But in the chaos all around me, I can still hear Grandpa say, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there crying, the land will save you, wait and see.